How many of you have heard that song before? Amazing Grace. Yeah. This is what I want you to pick up on. Look up here. Make eye contact with me just for a second. The grace isn't amazing until you first understand how horrendous the sin was. Got that? You see, what happens is, and I want to read a verse to you because Satan tries to tell us, he tries to trick us and tries to make us look at our sin in a way that makes that grace less amazing. Like, for instance, in Hebrews chapter number 3, verses 12 through 13, I'll have it. It'll be up on the board as well. See to it, brothers and sisters, that none of you have a sinful, unbelieving heart that turns away from the living God. But encourage one another daily, as long as it is called today, that none of you may be hardened by sin's deceitfulness. Or maybe your version says the deceitfulness of sin. You see, Satan's trick right now is as a believer or a non-believer, he wants to minimize how big your sin is because it's not that big, or he wants to maximize that your sin is so great, how could anybody ever love or forgive you? I wrote in my notes, he tells us that our sin is too little, that it's not that big of a deal. You know, come on. Or he tells us that maybe our sin is too big, and how could anybody love you or forgive you if that was the sin in your life? So when we look at sin, our view might be something like this. That God's grace is much greater than your sin because we've minimized our sin. It's not that big of a deal. And let me just be blunt honest with you. This is where a lot of Christians kind of live sometimes because I think we forget about how horrendous, how grotesque our sin was. So as we began to look at it, it's kind of like, well, God's grace is big, but, you know, in my case, it doesn't really have to cover a lot because I'm a pretty good person. He tells us that our sin is little. Now, we recognize the greatness of God's grace, but we minimize our sin, and we forget the severity of where we used to come from or where we came from. We talked last week, 2 points. We compare ourselves to others. And when we compare ourselves to others, we're looking pretty good. We're not looking quite as bad. And you can always find someone in a worse situation than you, a greater sinner than you. Or secondly, we begin to weigh the bad against the good. We look at all the bad that's in our life, and we try to minimize it by saying, well, but look at all the good I have. And doesn't it balance out? So therefore, we spend the rest of our lives trying to make the good continually outweigh the bad. Last week's quote was simply this: if the biggest sinner you know isn't you, then you don't know yourself very well. See, we live in a society and a culture that wants to point out people with bigger sins than us to make us feel better about what we're doing or what we're not doing. But he tells us our sin is too little, but sometimes Satan also, he tries this approach. He tells us that our sin is too big, and that equation might look something like this, that our sin is great, but God's grace, how could it be greater than my sin? It doesn't make any sense. Brian, you don't know where I've come from. On a Sunday morning, Pastor, you don't know where I was Friday night, Saturday night. You don't know what I did this week. So during this series, we've been talking about Hebrews 12:15, which was kind of the verse that started this quest all for me to sharing with our church. Hebrews 12:15 simply says this: see to it that no one falls short of the grace of God, or that no one misses the grace of God. And that's our intention and our purpose here. So in John chapter 4, we're going to talk today that God is more beautiful than our brokenness. John chapter number 4. If you look at verse number 4 in John chapter number 4, it simply says this: now he, Jesus, had to go through Samaria. Now, we find really quick in the New Testament this social inequality. There's Jews and Samaritans. They did not get along with each other. They did not like each other. In the day and age in which we live in, we talk about the uneasiness of our culture and the prejudice. This was going on even at this particular time. Jews would go out of their way not to be involved on a trip through Samaria. If you look at the New Testament map, any direction away from Jerusalem, Samaria was on the way, but they would circumvent it, sometimes taking 3 times as long just so they wouldn't have to go through Samaria. They didn't want to go through that part of the town. So when we read this verse, he had to go through Samaria. He had to go. Now, when I first hear that, and maybe even the Jews thought this when they heard this story, he had to go. Like, for instance, a little child, he had to brush his teeth. Or guys, he had to go to the tea room with his wife. You know what I'm talking about? That's something you would really want to do, but you have to. He had to go to Yankee Candle to smell candles, because no guy would go to Yankee Candle just to smell candles on his own. Right, men? Amen? Oh, that was so weak, guys. But that's not how this verse is. That's not how this phrase is. This phrase carries the connotation that it was necessary. There was an appointment. As God began to send his son Jesus, Jesus saw something that was going to happen in Samaria that he wanted to become a part of. It was an appointment of grace. So when Jesus arrives in John chapter number 4, well around noon, noon's the heat of the day, he sits down with his disciples and they go in town to get some food, and he's seated there. Now all of a sudden there's this Samaritan woman who begins this conversation. They begin this conversation with each other. Now, it's an unusual time for anybody to meet at the well. People normally came to that well in the morning or in the evening. This is how it would work. Basically, think of it as a community water hole or well. So early, early, early in the morning, ladies, they would get up and they would head to the well to get fresh drinking water. And they would use water even to help wash their clothes. But they got up first. Why? Because they knew about mid-morning, the men with their flocks and herds would come in and they would begin to drink. Now, who wants to drink water or have your clothes washed after a bunch of nasty animals have been wallowing around on it? So by that time, the water would settle, the well would keep replenishing itself. It would take most of the day. Then as the evening would come and the sun would begin to set again, they would hit to the water well again. So noontime was not prime time for anybody actually to be at this well. It was unusual time for that chore, for a woman to be there getting water. It was an unusual time uncommon that she was alone, because the women normally hung out in the morning and went together. Kind of like ladies, like whenever a lady has to go to the restroom, you know how they all go in herds? It's the exact same thing. They would all go together. I still think that's kind of funny. If a bunch of guys are together, you don't ever hear that comment, "Hey, guys, you need to go to the bathroom? Let's go, baby." You just don't hear it. But ladies, sure, they get up and go. But this woman's by herself. We're going to find out that her reputation, maybe she was either ashamed or people had distanced themselves from her to whereas this was the best possible time. It's hard to say if she avoided people or if they avoided her. But either way, in verse number 9, Jesus asked her for a drink. The Samaritan woman said to him, "You are a Jew and I am a Samaritan woman. How can you ask me for a drink? For Jews do not associate with Samaritans." And Jesus answered, "If you knew the gift of God and who it is that asks you for a drink, you would have asked him and he would have given you living water." She begins to point out that Jesus doesn't even have a bucket to draw from the well with. So how in the world is he going to satisfy her physical thirst? And then Jesus says this phrase, that he's living water. And if she drinks this water, she'll never thirst again. Look at verse number 15. This woman said to him, "Sir, give me this water so that I won't get thirsty and have to keep coming here to draw water." Now he told her, "Go call your husband and come back." Verse number 17, "I have no husband," she replied. Jesus said to her, "You are right when you've said you have no husband. The fact is you've had 5 husbands and the man you now have is not your husband. What you have just said is quite true." So pick up the awkwardness of this conversation. He says, "Go call your husband and come back." She says, "I have no husband." Now, Jesus could have simply said, "I know." But he goes farther than that. He says, "Yeah, I know you don't have a husband. As a matter of fact, you've had 5, and the one you're living with is not your husband." I love Mark and Bridget Jones and their little girl, Lily. They're in the nursery this morning, working in the nursery, watching our little guys. And they told me when Lily, we've known them for a long time, but when Lily was real young, Lily's favorite word is somebody would walk up to her and they would say something really cute and this is what Lily would respond: awkward. Have you ever had one of those awkward moments? Have you? One of my most awkward moments is when I walked up to this lady who was a friend of our church in Missouri, and I said, "Wow, now when are you expecting?" Awkward. She says, "I'm not." Now, what do you say at that? I'll tell you what I said. Well, Renee told me you were. That's where I'm coming from. But he says, "Go call your husband." I don't have a husband. He says, "I know you don't. As a matter of fact, you've had five, and the guy you're with now, he's not your husband." You see, Jesus does not step away from the truth. He begins to approach this woman exactly where she is, the reality of what she's done and the mess that her life is now, which is probably the very reason she's at this well all by herself with nobody else around. See, she can't pretend that everything's okay. And Jesus does it, and who knows everything, and he says, no, the situation is not okay as well, which begins to open up the opportunity, because if she's going to receive his grace, then she needs to stop pretending like it's not a big deal, that she needs to stop hiding in her sin. I want you to pick up on this point. Before we can collide with the grace of God, we must first collide with the truth of our own sin. You see, most of us, when we experience that great collision, is when we begin to understand, man, I am messed up. Man, I'm in trouble. I've got to experience God's grace. Then all of a sudden, bam, and you see it and you witness it and you begin to understand it. That's this great collision of grace. I wonder, as Jesus approached the woman at the well, I wonder if Jesus approached you and me this morning, what he would say. If he could speak truth into our life. Maybe he would say, you know, your short temper keeps everyone around you on edge. And there's a great deal of bitterness around you, and it's growing in your family. Maybe he'd say, your drinking has gotten out of control. It's affecting more people than just you. Your porn problem is killing any chance of intimacy you have in your marriage, and you're to blame. Your flirting is leading you down a path that will eventually devastate your very family. You're choosing your live-in boyfriend over your relationship with me, and it's going to have to be either one or the other. Can't have both. You're going deeper into debt to feel better about yourself, but the water from that well, it never will satisfy. Maybe he says, your self-righteous and legalistic spirit is causing people at your job to stay away from me. Maybe he says, your judgmental attitude and your harsh tone are costing you a relationship with your grandkids. You see, when Jesus begins to speak truth into our lives, in order for us to understand his grace, we have to, first of all, listen. Her response in this is going, we're going to find out, she's going to try to change the subject. But in order for her to be able to experience God's grace, she first has to come to grips with where she's at, where her own sin is. And as Jesus speaks this difficult truth to this woman, like many of us would do, she tries to change the subject. In verse 19, she says, sir, the woman said, I can see that you're a prophet. Well, duh, you know. Jesus just said, yeah, I know your living situation. I see that you're a prophet. So I have a question for you. Our ancestors worshipped on this mountain, but you Jews claim that the place we must worship is in Jerusalem. And she begins to take this subject away from her sin, and she begins to want to talk about church and religion. And I think that's an assumption that many people have when they're kind of walking away from God's confrontation to their life, when he puts upon their heart the truth that's involved when we get involved in our sin. So there's three assumptions. First of all, assumption number one, Jesus wants nothing to do with me. He wants nothing to do with me. Did you hear the way he responded? He basically says that I'm lying and I'm not truthful. You see, with that response, we can say, if he's not interested in me, then why should I have really any interest in him? I want grace, but not at that extent, not at that cost. You see, I found this, that rejected people build walls to keep people from getting close because they don't want to be hurt again. So therefore, they say, you know, want nothing to do with me. You know, I've talked with different couples that thought that God had given up on their relationship, their troubled marriages, their problems, and that it was too late, that it was way too late. Why? Because they think everything that I've done, the deceit, the dishonesty, the trust breaking, it's too late. Why would Jesus want to have anything to do with me? Or maybe the second assumption, Jesus is more interested in religion than me. He's more interested in the things that religious leaders talk about. She tries to distract Jesus by talking about religion. But when the church gets caught up in religious arguments and interpretive differences, we communicate to the world that the church is more focused on your behavior or your attitude or your denomination or your political affiliation than the church is loving sinners. Maybe the third assumption is this. Jesus is making an offer that's too good to be true. He promises her water that will forever quench her thirst. Now, if you look at her life, she has been involved with all kinds of men who have made all kinds of promises. So she's skeptical when this one guy says, hey, I got a big deal for you. This is pretty incredible water. And I believe that each of these assumptions can separate us from God's grace. So look at verse number 25 of John chapter number 4. The woman said, I know that Messiah called Christ is coming. And when he comes, he will explain everything to us. Isn't that kind of ironic? She's talking to Jesus here, okay? And she says, there's this guy who's going to come. He's the Messiah. When he comes, he'll explain everything and he'll make clear. And I don't really know the temperament of Jesus. I don't know if he was a smiler, winker, whatever, but I had a feeling Jesus probably smiled as he hears this, and he makes this next statement. He declared, I, the one speaking to you, am he. Now, as I began to study this past week, I tried to find another portion of Scripture in the New Testament where Jesus announced that he was the Messiah. He didn't volunteer. It wasn't candid. But he told this woman, I'm that Messiah. I'm that Son of God. Now, this is what I think is interesting. Wouldn't it seem like if Jesus told anybody, he would tell his disciples who were following him, or he would tell maybe somebody he was preaching to? But no, he chooses to make himself known as the Messiah to this Samaritan woman with a bad reputation, who'd been married 5 times, who was living with a boyfriend. Ladies and gentlemen, that is a beautiful picture of God's grace. Of God's grace. You see, some of you here today think that the worst thing that can happen to you is if those secret sins become exposed. You'd like to continue living where you're at that nobody else knows what's going on. And you don't want anyone to know. And since God already knows, maybe that's the very reason you try to avoid him, because it brings back this guilt feeling, or you know what you shouldn't be doing. You think the worst thing that could happen to you is that you get found out and you're forced to confront the truth. But I'm here to tell you this morning, that's not the worst thing that could happen to you, is that your secret's exposed, that your sin is made known to those around you. The worst thing that could happen to you is that you go through life and nobody knows. No one ever finds out. You carry this incredible guilt and shame, and you try to keep up this facade of what people know about you, they think about you. You spend the rest of your life trying to outrun God because you think he's chasing you to collect what you owe him. But he's not really chasing you to give you what you deserve. He wants to give you what you could not afford, and that's simply God's grace. God's grace. With the events in my life and my family and over the last few years, I've had the opportunity of dealing with people, specifically with this thought. Most of us have this persona of how we want to be perceived. We want to look good. We want to for people to think nice things about us. We want to be represented well in our community. We have We want our kids, friends to look at us in a certain light. We want our boss to see us in a certain way. And when we're talking about allowing God's grace to really abound, that you have to know your own sin, this is what I know about myself. This is what I know about you, is that we have a tendency to hide our sin. We have a tendency to cover up our sin. We have a tendency not to tell anybody else because we think that once that's exposed, the hurt that it will bring. I have a very close friend in my life right now that's going through a great ordeal. For the last 30 years, he's lived a life of deceit. His family didn't know. His parents didn't know. His family, nobody knew. But he was exposed for what he was involved in. In my conversation with him just recently, there was this, I can't say relief, because relief doesn't describe it. But can you imagine carrying around this scar tissue of sin and embarrassment and guilt and shame with you all your life, then all of a sudden you don't want anybody to know about it and you're guarding and protecting it, and then all of a sudden it's out? But I've noticed a temperament change in him, in that this anxiety he would carry and this frustration he would carry and this hurt is gone. And I believe it's because that burden of hiding that, suppressing that, is done. See, there's people here this morning, you've got stuff going on in your life nobody knows about. And you're doing your very best not to let anybody else know about it. Why? Because if that secret got out, I would just be looked at in such an awful light. Well, I'm telling you, when you begin to understand God's grace, the first thing you have to do is come to grips that God knows it, and he's aware of it. And where your sin abounds, grace even more abounds. You see, that's not bad news. It's actually great news about God's grace. When we become more aware of God's amazing grace, our hearts will change, just like this woman at the well. You see, before she met Jesus, she didn't want anyone to see her. She didn't want anyone to know her past. She felt ashamed. She could never forgive herself. But once she began to collide with God's grace, and once God's grace was shown to her, she began to look at life completely different. Look at John chapter number 4, verse 28. Then leaving her water jar, the woman went back to the town and said to the people, "Come see a man who told me everything I ever did. Could this be the Messiah?" And they came out of the town and they made their way toward him. See, when she began to understand that her sin was not this secret thing, this man approached her, said, "Yeah, you're going to have to deal with this." There was just this bit of relief. Now, when a pastor preaches this kind of message in a church, have you noticed that during this message there aren't a lot of amens? Amen, brother. Oh, that's good stuff. Yeah, yeah. You know, because we all have a tendency to minimize and hide our sin. You know, there are sins that creep up, and we see them on TV in a sitcom or on a TV show, and we look at them. Well, that's just normal. Boy, I tell you what. I remember we used to talk about Jerry Springer's show. How many of you have ever seen the Jerry Springer show? You're forgiven, but raise your hand. You've ever seen the Jerry Springer show, okay? You look at that and you go, "Oh my gosh, how could that happen?" You know what? That's kind of the world we live in now. Well, Pastor Brian, does anything shock you? Not anymore. Not anymore. So I got rid of my cable TV, because I want to have money to retire on one day. So I got rid of my cable TV. So I'm watching TV the other day, and nobody's around the house but me, and I flipped across Jerry Springer. And my curiosity says, you know, I actually have Jerry Springer written down on my message. I haven't seen Jerry Springer in a number of years. I'm going to watch it. I didn't even make it 60 seconds into this program, and I thought, this is so stupid. Do you know why that program is so wow to many people? I believe when we see the extreme of what sin is, it makes us feel just a little bit better about ourselves. One thing I did notice as they're showing this show, and again, it's a waste of my time. It's 60 seconds I'll never be able of my life to get back again. But as I'm watching this, this is what they do. They pan the camera on the people on the stage, and then they pan the camera on the crowd. And the crowd's out there going, yeah, leave that man. He's a loser. You know, I'm thinking, you know what? Just stop a second. What happens if we put your life in the spotlight for just a second? You do realize that in our community and our culture, that we're going back deep into what you used to do and who you used to be with and what you were like in high school. Secret sins will be exposed, so be very careful who points the finger. And I started thinking about that, how this fits into this morning's message. You see, it's easy for us to look and point and say, I can't believe that individual did that. That sickens me. I'm shamed by that. My grandma, Sheridan, used to tell me, when you point your finger at somebody, anybody know what I'm about to say? How many of you got pointing back at you? Well, four if you point funny, but I'm talking about really you got three, okay? You at least have three or four, but you should be looking at yourself as well. Two purposes for this message this morning. First of all, if you're broken, if there's sin in your life, maybe it's a secret sin, you are oh so beautiful to God. For God so loved the world that he gave his only son to a world who would ridicule him, blaspheme him, push him away. That's who God sent his son into the world for. The neatest thing about the grace is that of all the people in this particular story, he picked the woman that most of us would say, oh, you know her? Yeah, you remember that? Have you ever seen that lady that's down at the well around noontime? Oh man, she's had quite the life. I'll tell you what I heard about her, and then you begin talking. That's the extreme of God's grace. You see, for God's grace to abound, the sin has to be exposed. Now, we might say, well, her lifestyle and my lifestyle, oh, yeah, God has shown her more grace. Again, it's because you're forgetting to acknowledge the sin that you have in your life, even right now. Because if you're pushing back against me right now saying, I'm not that sinful, you are bountiful pride. It's not me. I'm a pretty good person. I'm in church. It's a Sunday morning. I could be the last day at the fair, or I could be getting in line over at El Arroyo's for lunch right now, or I could be, yeah. When God's grace and mercy begin to collide with our shame and guilt, it's incredibly messy. But God says it's beautiful to him. That's what his grace was for. Amazing grace, how sweet the sound. Yeah, it's incredible, but you have to realize the next phrase that saved a wretch like me. This is where I'm at. So maybe you were here this morning and your brokenness is probably more than you can share with anybody. There's things right now that go on in your life, that go on in your mind that nobody else knows about. And you're carrying this incredible guilt and shame, and it weighs you down, and people think nice things about you, and they know you go to church, and they know that you believe in God, and they know that you're married and have a family. But I'm telling you, God's grace is sufficient for forgiveness of every sin. Secondly, this morning, not only is your brokenness, can you bounce back from that because of God's grace? And we're going to go here in the next few weeks. When you begin to see your brokenness, it gives you a little more patience with the people around you. Pick up on that just for a second. The way that you respond to other people. It's incredible the way that things change. Always turn your phone off. This is what I want you to walk away from this morning. Right now in my life, I'm dealing with friends whose secret sins have surfaced. And they think there's nothing worse than that. I'm telling you, there is something worse than that. The thing that's worse than that you never experience God's grace in those situations. Never. Well, Pastor, the reason I really want to talk about it is because I'm embarrassed. Yeah, I know. This is what I've even found out as a pastor. Normally, when people in the pew began to share their weaknesses, Frank, you can back me up on this. When they began to expose what's in their closet, guess what? They don't want to be around you anymore. You know why? Because you know their secret. Because you know what's going on. And I'm here to tell you, when all of a sudden that gets out, do you know it's not the condemnation that comes from a pastor? It's the incredible amount of grace that hopefully I can share what God did for you and not judge you. The things I've experienced as a pastor, when people begin to share things with me, well, Pastor, I need to tell you about this. I remember one of the first things. Renee, do you remember when I was a youth pastor up in Denver, Colorado? I've been a youth pastor for probably, 3 months. You remember the young lady who came to us and she knocked on our door and she was in our youth group and she said, can we talk for a second? And I said, sure. And she came in and sat down on my couch. She said, right now, I just want to let you know that the police are arresting my father because he's been sexually abusing me since I was 12 years old and I turned 18 today and now I can press charges. Ladies and gentlemen, when you're in Bible college, they don't cover that, how you respond. What do you say? I remember Renee and I just trying to console her and to love her. And then she walked out and we were just like, I want you to understand this though. You're sitting there holding on to this that nobody knows. It is God's grace that is amazing. Once he recognizes your brokenness, and once you come to terms, then all of a sudden you begin to see God in a completely different light. It doesn't seem like it's worth it though. But no matter where your sin is, God's grace is greater. God's forgiveness is greater. Would you bow your heads for a word of prayer this morning?